surface use only, too irritating and too toxic when used internally. On the handout I gave you earlier, in addition, there are a couple of compounds, surface only, but the other big issue is, can we get them isotonic in some kind of stable preparation that is not too irritating to the structures of the eye? And then benzocaine, while it's good at the surface, is not one of those compounds. So take a look at those two as well. There's a couple of compounds that are prepared for, especially for ocular use only. They stay on the surface, and we can get them in a formulation that is non-irritating to the eye. So that's basically what that's all about, is to show you what's available. But now we're back to this particular chart, and we're up here in this corner still talking a little bit about barbiturates. And I had mentioned the barbiturate pharmacology in general. Just to give you a few of the highlights, depressant, okay, but a particular note for depression, respiratory, that's the big issue in terms of toxicity, is problems with respiration. The other thing to note is that even at high therapeutic doses, you can sometimes have problems regulating body temperature. Remember I said that heat thermostat tends to be depressed or reset, so there needs to be some issues that way. One other thing of note, most of this is of historical note at this point, because we don't use barbiturates as sedative hypnotics that much anymore. But one other thing of note is they tended to be depressing on GI activity. So constipation with chronic use became a bit of a problem as well. Where do we see barbiturates used? Well, the only compound that we see used regularly anymore is phenobarbital. Still used quite often in epilepsy. We also see phenobarbital used in another way, first of all, because it's on the shelf and you don't have to special order it, but also because in terms of enzyme induction, phenobarbital is at the top of the heap. While all of these can induce liver enzymes, phenobarbital and In general, the longer acting the compound, the better it is at enzyme induction. That's just a generality. But the long acting compounds are generally over in the real strong enzyme inducers. Okay? Now, why do I say that? It's because there is a condition. I better back off. I'm looking at a fetus at term. One of the last things that tends to be developed in a fetus at term is the enzyme set that is necessary to deal with red blood corpuscle destruction. One of the last things that gets developed are those enzymes. And one of the ones that tends to be developed way late is a compound called glucuronyl transferase, a compound, an enzyme called glucuronyl transferase. That being said, what happens if the infant is premature? Generally speaking, that enzyme is not available. As red blood corpuscles start being broken down, we start seeing the buildup of intermediate byproducts, a backlog, if you will, because that enzyme is not working as efficiently as it should. And not only that, but if it's premature and it has been born normally, quote-unquote, what's one of the last things that we generally do? We dump the umbilical cord blood into the fetus. because the fetus has its own complement, it's got all this extra blood along for the ride as well to give us a good start in life, quote unquote. But generally speaking, we have to deal with excess of red blood corpuscles. How do we deal with them? We start breaking them down. And so often then, at the beginning, we see the development of what we call neonatal jaundice. Because we're breaking down red blood corpuscles, and yet we can't break them down all the way because of the lack of this enzyme. Now, what do we normally do to correct that problem? What will stimulate this enzyme's development? Hello? Light. What kind of light? UV. Okay? However, sometimes supplemental to that, or sometimes in place of that, we will administer phenobarbital as a stimulant for this enzyme induction. Now, obviously, phenobarbital has some issues. Probably in this country, up until about 10, 15 years ago, there were a billion doses of barbiturate made a year. Most of it were overseas, now it's all shipped out to Puerto Rico or whatever. But there were about a billion doses made, and of that billion doses, it was estimated that fully 10% did not make it to the retail market. That somewhere along the way, they were hijacked. Barbiturate can be made in a bathtub. Malonic acid and urea, it's not rocket science chemistry. Okay? Put those two together. So we still have approximately 1,500 cases of barbiturate toxicity a year in this country that we have to deal with, either plain or mixed with other depressant types of compounds, usually alcohol. But in terms of sedative hypnotic activity, generally, we've got better compounds, and I'll talk about them here toward the end of the hour. In addition to the respiratory toxicity that I mentioned, other issues with the barbiturate were basically in terms of therapy. They weren't producing sleep. They were producing a sleep-like state. And some of the things, as we got into studying sleep physiology in the laboratory, okay, when you have this sleep cycle, okay, generally you will come up and you will touch, as you come up each time, stage one. Now if you're an old geezer like me, you go right through stage one and you get to stage zero, which is what? Awake, so I do a couple of skull moves or look at my latest Playboy and then I go back to sleep, right? Got it? But in a normal young adult like yourselves, generally, as high as you get in stage one, generally you will touch that for maybe 5 or 10 minutes each cycle. If you are using a barbiturate chronically, you never get there. You never go back to stage one. The shifts back to stage one decrease significantly. Okay. You just don't get there as often as you used to. Going through stages three and four generally are quicker. So the slope, if you will, of coming up and going down through stage three and four is steeper. Doesn't take as long. So that leaves two stages, stage two and REM. And we've discovered that the following occurs. The latency to the first REM period increases. In fact, you may not even see a REM period the first cycle. the cycles that will include REM decrease, mostly because you never see REM in which cycle? The first one. I mean, that's a no-brainer. If you don't see it in the first cycle, the number of cycles that contain REM is going to go down, okay? And the time spent in REM per cycle decreases significantly, particularly toward the end of sleep, when REM cycles in a normal individual do what? Increase, occupy a greater percentage of the time. So let's see. Stage 1 decreases. Time in stages 3 and 4 decrease. Time in REM. Guess what? Guess where you spend most of your time? I was going to say most of your waking moments. That would be a real... Most of your sleep-like state moments are spent in stage 2. And where did I say the most refreshing sleep was? REM. So you wake up loggy, drugged, what we used to call a barbiturate hangover. Okay? Because you're just not as refreshed. So therapeutically, not optimal. So, and as I said, because of the enzyme induction and because of some pharmacodynamic tolerance that we'll talk about probably on Wednesday, okay, you had to start taking more and more to get to the same effect, which was not that good an effect to begin with. So that there was an addictive liability built into the drug as well. For these reasons, we started looking at the lack of therapeutic efficacy, the problems with acute overdose of toxicity. And by the way, the safety index on these drugs is not relative. Well, how do I say this? It's good compared to a few other drug classes we'll talk about, but it's not that good. I mean, generally speaking, somebody who's a virgin to barbiturate hasn't been using a lot of it. Okay? Generally, about 15 times the therapeutic dose, you're in big trouble with most barbiturates. Now, that changes a little. The shorter-acting ones tended to be a little bit less than 15. The longer-acting ones a little bit more. But generally, 15, and you're in lethal territory. You're in big trouble. You can get toxic with as little as 5 times the therapeutic dose. Okay? So, understand that if you come into me as a pharmacist with a fresh prescription of barbiturate from the local physician for sleep, generally speaking, the prescription was written one at that time, PRN sleep. What's bedtime? HS, right? 1 HS PRN sleep. How many more in the bottle? Good guess. 30. Month supply. What did you say about toxicity? You know? So you could do yourself in with the first prescription. Okay? So we wanted then to look for a safer alternative. We wanted to look for a more effective alternative in terms of producing a more normal sleep-like state, a more normal hypnosis. And there was one other thing that drove us to look for alternatives, and that is greed. What company did I say had the patent? Lilly, down in Indianapolis. Is that still Eli Lilly, or have they gotten swallowed up? But anyhow, they had the patent. I looked up. They developed 2,000 compounds. Probably 3 dozen of them got to clinical trial, and perhaps a dozen or 15 got to market. They sold off a couple to get around the antitrust laws, but they pretty much had the market cornered. Because which ones did they sell off? The lousier ones. You know, not the good ones. The lousier ones. Okay? So, greed. other drug companies wanted some of this sedative hypnotic action. So here's some of the compounds that got developed as alternatives, made it to market as viable alternatives. Chlorhydrate became the predominant compound in nursing facilities, geriatrics. Cheap and inexpensive to make, relatively inexpensive, so it got on a lot of nursing home formularies. It is an excellent sleep inducer, has little or no drug hangover because it just doesn't stay around that long either. Something about chlorhydrate, though, at least part, if not most of its therapeutic efficacy was due to trichloroethanol, an active metabolite. So what did you have to keep watching while you were getting this compound? Liver activity, okay? So, good onset, relatively short duration, so little chance of drug hangover. So it became a good compound for sleep induction, particularly in geriatrics. It is a cholinesterase inhibitor at higher doses. So that became the big issue in terms of side effects. In addition, among the compounds, the barbiturates and others that I'm going to talk about, this one tended to be the most susceptible to potentiation by alcohol. So you definitely did not want to give grandma a shot of whiskey or a glass of wine while she was taking this compound, unless you wanted to put her to sleep for a long, long time. And it became one of the first of what we call the non-barbiturate sedative hypnotics. Okay? So good for falling asleep. Second compound. F-chlorvinyl. The trade name for this compound is Flacidil. By the way, both chlorohydrate and F-chlorovinyl, as you can see, have halogen molecules, or atoms, I guess you would say. You know, what's this a throwback to? Hello? Yeah. To get sedative hypnotic activity, you've got to have a halogen, you know, that scale going down with general anesthesia. It's general anesthetic all over again. Ethyl group, chloral group, should have a good compound for general depressant action. Okay? And indeed it was. But both chlorohydrate and F-chlorovinyl are liquids. And they were given in gel caps. And that halogen molecule made them smell terrible. So you open a fresh bottle of chlorohydrate or Flacidil, you know right away if the capsule's been broken. Okay, it just jumps right out at you like a skunk. Okay, so yeah, I remember that distinctly because it's the junior pharmacist on staff who got to open the bottle and, you know, dispense 30s or whatever we were going to package them as. Yeah, you guessed it. So, yeah, I remember the smell distinctly. Flacidil introduced in 1955. Again, short onset within 20 minutes. Shorter duration of action, 2 to 3 hours. So again, it was good for sleep induction. Like chlorohydrate, this compound only interferes with sleep cycle, with REM sleep while it's active. So we get you to sleep and hopefully then you would revert to a normal sleep cycle during the last 4 hours or so that you were asleep. And it seemed to work because people would generally be more refreshed on this compound than they were with a typical large turbine. A couple of things. We had to watch this compound in terms of absorption. Sometimes if you took it on a empty stomach in particular, the absorption would be so rapid that people would go through a giddy stage, lightheaded giddy stage. Is giddy a word? G-I-D-D-Y, giddiness, you know? Everything's fine and rosy, you know. And that would be an issue with some people. Like chloral hydrate, you definitely needed to avoid alcohol with this compound. Now, the other reason I mentioned this, and I may have mentioned it in drug action, did I talk to you about the Central Michigan University professor, CMU professor of drug action? 14 Placidil a week from us. You know, but he had pharmacies up and down US 27 as he's ringing a bell. All Placidil for nighttime sleep aid. Enzyme inducer. Okay, enzyme inducer. So he had a liver that wouldn't quit in terms of being able to metabolize these compounds over a period of time. He built up that kind of power. Okay, the third non-barbituric sedative hypnotic that I just want to mention is glutathione, third or fourth, actually. It's glutathione or Dorin. This was Seva's compound. I introduced in 1954. Glutathione, SIVA's initial data, which was verified independently, suggested that 500 milligrams of this compound was the therapeutic equivalent of 100 milligrams of pentobarbital. Both in onset and duration and what it did to the sleep cycle, pretty much exactly the same. So this was an alternative to the barbiturates in terms of sleep maintenance. It tended to last in the system 4 to 6 hours. And pretty much the same effect. However, the safety margin with this compound tends to be less than that of pentobarbital. And the reason for that is that as opposed to pentobar, glutathione tends to have a much greater effect on blood pressure. Okay? And it's generally hypotension, big time. Okay? And like the respiratory depression, with all these other compounds, the ability to get tolerance to this decrease in blood pressure did not occur like the tolerance to the efficacy of this sedative hypnotic effect. So we tended to get in trouble with blood pressure worldwide through this. The other thing about the glutathione that tended to be an issue is even if there therapeutic doses that tended to have anti-muscarinic activity. So people would come in to the pharmacy all the time with some issues like mydriasis, urinary retention, constipation, all the typical anti-muscarinic effects that you would expect tended to be problems. Okay, so while it was therapeutically the equivalent in terms of its usefulness as an agent, it tended to pale in comparison to pentobarbital. Final compound developed relatively later and did not have much of a heyday is a compound that generically is known as methacrolone. Its trade name, Qualu. Its sedative hypnotic action was discovered during its screening. It was originally put together as an anti-malarial. And while its efficacy in malaria is nil, it was discovered it has some sedative hypnotic action. Okay, it tends to be a more selective depressant, and it's one of the chinks in the armor that I'll be starting on here in a few minutes, a more selective depressant than the other compounds. While it's generally listed as a general CNS depressant, it is somewhat selective. It tends to favor polysynaptic pathways, particularly of motor nerves. It is possible to get a flaccid paralysis of an individual without their losing consciousness. You can sedate them to the point they can't move. Literally. Because muscles don't work. Okay. The problem here, of course, is if, just like the arm and leg muscles don't work, guess what other muscles don't work? Answer, respiratory voluntary musculature. So we have to worry about that, and that was the problem. Okay. The other thing was with methacrolone or Qualude is that some people reacted with delirium and hallucinations. While methacrolone or Qualude, which was developed in the late 60s in the U.S., it hit the market in the late 60s, had a relatively short life as a sedative hypnotic, it had a longer life, a folklore life, if you will, because there was a lot of word of mouth that methacrolone was a good aphrodisiac. Perhaps by promoting flaccid paralysis, I don't know. But nobody ever came up with a clinical trial of just how aphrodisiac it was. But it remained in the folklore, particularly on the West Coast, for a long period of time. And in fact, up until the early 90s, a common mix on the street was what they called teas and blues. The T stand for an analgesic we'll talk about at the end of the semester called Toluen, and blue being Qualude. T's and blues. To promote interpersonal relations. Okay, no pain, flaccid paralysis, you can get the picture. Okay? So it was still around that way, and it's still sold in other parts of the world. But not in this country so much anymore because of where we're headed on this chart. Okay. You'll notice that while we're talking sedative hypnotics, both barbiturate and non-barbiturate. Generally speaking, here's where we are with all of those compounds. I haven't said squat about sedation, anxiolytic activity. Okay? In fact, we did not have a good anxiolytic compound. The best we could do Placidil, made by Wyeth, had come out Wyatt had come out with a sedative that they trained in Equinil. The trade name for Equinil is a trade name. The generic name for this compound is methylbamate. Methylbamate, it's a carbamate derivative. Methylbamate was the basic compound that we used as an anxiolytic. In fact, Equinil is basically a centrally acting muscle relaxer. While it doesn't produce flaccid paralysis, it does kind of relax you. And included in that relaxation would be the typical, we'll talk about this next semester, tension headache types of muscles, you know. You get all stressed out and your muscles get tense. So while it didn't relieve the anxiety necessarily, it relieved a lot of the symptomology surrounding the anxiety. And this was the other compound that CMU professor used. I mean, Wyatt was happy to see him walk in the door. Equinil and Placido both. And generally, it's one every 4 hours or so, Equinil. That was the best we had as a sedative until 1964. And in 1964, Smith Klein comes out with a series of compounds. A new ring structure. That now is generally known as the benzodiazepine ring structure. And three compounds are put on the U.S. market at this point in time. This is a few pages back in the anxiolytic section. Compounds are librium, or diazepoxide, valium, or diazepam, and cerax, or oxazepam. They had developed probably 100 compounds, and these three all had very promising scores as anxiolytics. We generally had developed at that time tests for anxiety level, and these scored very well, so they all came to market. Being smart business people, they sold the patent rights to oxazepam to Wyeth, because Wyeth was interested in sedative hypnotic compounds. Of the three, guess which one is the worst? Oxazepam. Librium and Valium, however, become very dominant players in the United States market as anxiolytics. Now remember, we don't know squat as to what causes anxiety or what causes what we're doing therapeutically to produce anxiolytic action or sedative action or general anesthetic action. All we understand at this point, you know, we're still in, it's got to have an alpha group and it's got to be halogenated and that. No. But what was interesting about these compounds is that they produced this anxiolytic action selectively. They didn't have any of this other stuff associated with them in any great degree. Anxiolytic action was where it was at. Okay? They produced, if you will, sedation. Not hypnosis, just sedation. said, we were starting to produce chinks in this paradigm that we had established, saying that sedation, that is anxiolytic action, and hypnosis were just two stops, just two stations on this general depressant train ride that one would take from normal down to death. Well, it doesn't have to be that way, these compounds suggested. And so Librium and Valium become very popular very quickly, particularly Valium as an anxiolytic. Valium has some significant muscle relaxant activity in addition to a central anxiolytic effect. It's kind of neat that way. But Valium pretty much replaced, quote, DAOs, unquote. Remember that old shtick I gave you about the barbiturate sedatives? Barbiturates were pretty much then, after 1965 or so, regulated to just hypnosis. And it's not like they weren't pretty much just being used for that before then, but this pretty much put the nail in the coffin. We're going to use benzodiazepines as anxiolytics, and we are going to use barbiturates for hypnotic effect. The other reason why these compounds became so popular relatively quickly was the fact that their therapeutic index tended to be much greater than that of any of the other compounds we had. In fact, some independent studies with Librium suggested that therapeutic index as high as 40. And like their lack of hypnotic activity, typically benzodiazepines had none of the barbiturate problems with respiratory depression, cardiovascular, depression of the heat thermostat. I'll get into that a little more on Wednesday. But generally, the whole pharmacology tended to be somewhat different. Okay. Now, this is the tag for today, and I assume they switched the clocks around, and I'm good. Here's the interesting thing. As you might suspect, people get on the benzodiazepine bandwagon. Now, one drug company has that molecule kind of locked up, but other drug companies are looking at other molecules, and that one drug company decides we ought to get some more molecules on the market. And so a lot of work in the late 60s, early 70s goes into developing alternative compounds to Librium and Valium, because particularly Valium is making a ton of money. Okay? And the interesting one is this one. It is developed in the early 1970s. It comes on the market about 73, 74. The compound is Dalmane or Flurazepam. Okay? And what really, it wasn't a shock to people involved in the research and the science, but to the general medical community, it was a shock. Dalmane is a hypnotic. It has little or no anxiolytic activity. Another nail in the coffin of our paradigm of that general CNS depressant type of activity needed for sedation and hypnosis. Here's something that is selecting just hypnosis. And furthermore, the sleep-like state tends to not be as disrupting to normal sleep as with barbiturates. That is, we do see some more REM here. We do see a more normal sine wave curve than what we were used to with the barbiturates. Okay? Galmine or flurazepam. And the question becomes, what is going on? What is there about benzodiazepines that makes them different than chlorohydrate or acetobarbital as hypnotics? What makes them different than phenobarbital as sedatives? Okay? And the answer is how they interact with a receptor that is discovered at about the same time. A receptor known as GABA sub A that I mentioned at the end of the last hour. A receptor that is responsible for chloride conductance. So let's just talk about this receptor a little bit as I segue to Wednesday. Notice that it looks like a molar, doesn't it? Okay? But if I were to take and turn this 90 degrees, what I would be looking at as I look down on the membrane is something that looks like this. That is, what I'm looking at here is, or are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 polypeptide chains hooked together to form a donut hole, a pore in the membrane. Okay? Now, you'll notice one of the polypeptides is labeled alpha. One of the polypeptides is labeled beta. One is labeled gamma. In addition to alpha, beta, and gamma, we have delta, epsilon, pi, rho, and theta as separate polypeptide chains that can be a part of this receptor. Not only that, but there are at least 6 varieties of alpha, 3 varieties of beta, 3 varieties of gamma, and 2 varieties of delta. Now, GABA-ACE receptors are all what we would call pentameric, to the best of our knowledge. That is, they all have 5 proteins or polypeptides to make up this donut hole. Okay? But the thing is, how many different choices do we have to make up those 5? There are GABA-A receptors that are uniform in that they're all alpha or they're all beta. Whether they're all alpha 1 or beta 3 or whatever, we're not sure, but at least they're all alpha or they're all beta. But with, what is it, 7 or 8 different different types and different subtypes, I mean the possibilities are endless. Okay? So, understand that to begin with. Now, in terms of mechanism, I'll elaborate a little more, but the general mechanism for anesthetics and or general depressants is to interact with alpha and or beta receptors of GABA-A, alpha or beta subunits of GABA-A. Okay. generally speaking, most all GABA-A receptors have an alpha and or beta subunit. Very, very rare for them not to have one. Interact, and GABA itself generally binds in the cleft between an alpha and a beta, or an beta and a gamma, alpha and beta subunit, I'm sorry. So what happens? We have a neuron. GABA is released, comes across the synapse, and hits its receptor, or its semi-receptor, if you will, on this receptor complex. It's active site, active unit in one or both of those proteins. The receptor opens up, chloride flows through, we have a hyperpolarization, an inhibitory potential develop, inhibition, okay, which leads to depression, if you will, way on down the line. The thing about benzodiazepines is that they also have a receptor. Okay. It is located generally between an alpha and a gamma subunit, sometimes between a beta and a gamma, but most all the time between an alpha and a gamma. A benzodiazepine receptor, and as opposed to the general halogenated volatile anesthetics, as opposed to the barbiturates and other general depressants that interact right in the area of the GABA binding site, benzodiazepines act at a separate site, and they act to allosterically change the GABA binding site to make it more sensitive, more receptive to GABA. As we'll see on Wednesday, GABA is not needed for general anesthesia or general depression. But if you give a benzodiazepine, what do you have to have around in order for it to be effective? GABA. Because all it does is it allosterically modifies that receptor, that binding site, I'm sorry. It modifies the receptor so that GABA can bind more easily. We get more pronounced GABA effect. With that, I'll stop. We'll see you Wednesday.